Блогер, значит, журналист.
Госдума сделала еще один шаг к ужесточению антитеррористического...
Госдума быстро получил название «Интернет».
Приравнивающий популярные блоги к СМИ.
Люди должны нести ответственность за свои слова.
Всего пользователям ЖЖ, Твиттера и Фейсбука. Ведешь блог, отвечай за словам. Комитет Госдумы по информационной...
New restrictions for online journalists. Stricter regulations for foreign internet companies. The virtual death of Russia's premier independent social network. And a rough week in court for Russia's most famous blogger. With the world's media focused on the unrest in Ukraine and the possibility of a Russian invasion there, the Kremlin has been busy making life miserable for Russia's netroots at home. New legislation requires bloggers with more than 3,000 daily visitors to register and be regulated as mass media outlets. It also requires foreign internet companies like Google and Facebook to have their Russian language servers located physically in Russia, where data can more easily be mined by the security services. And ВКонтакте founder Pavel Durov, who, after losing his company, surfaced in Europe and said he wasn't returning to Russia. And oh, by the way, anti-corruption blogger and opposition leader Alexei Navalny just had his house arrest extended for 6 months and lost a libel case over one of his blog posts. All eyes may be on Ukraine, but inside Russia, Vladimir Putin's power vertical appears to be striking a death blow against the fledgling power horizontal. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome back, Kirill.
Hello.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Middletown, Connecticut, my sleepy and charming home state, is Kevin Rothrock, editor of Runet Echo at Global Voices and author of the blog A Good Treaty and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. Welcome back, Kevin. Good to see you again.
Hello, hello.
Speaking at a media forum in St. Petersburg this week, Putin said the internet originated as a, quote, CIA project and, quote, is still developing as such. To resist that influence, Putin said, Russia needs to, quote, fight for its interests online. Well, just to set the record straight, Vladimir Vladimirovich, the internet was actually invented by the Pentagon, not the CIA. I was going to make a snarky quip about how the CIA invented LSD, but it in fact didn't. So we'll just move on from there. Facts can be pesky things. A few years ago, I would have dismissed this comment as one of Putin's traditional rhetorical diatribes. But given what's been happening in Russia recently, it's a bit ominous. Kevin, let's start with you, since you monitor the Russian blogosphere for a living. What's the attitude out there? Is there fear, apprehension, resignation? What do you see online right now with all this going on?
I think you see the whole gamut of emotional reactions. Certainly people are afraid that I think Anton Nosik, the father of the Runet or whatever his title is today. He said something along the lines that he expects Facebook and maybe it was also Twitter to be blocked and closed inside Russia by like the summer. Mm. And, you know, it certainly sounds alarmist, and there are people that would say that is alarmist. I think my attitude is that I think that's sort of an extreme possibility, but it is, I suppose, a possibility. I'm inclined usually to the safe bet is always that the status quo is what will be the status quo tomorrow as well, right? But certainly the direction of things is that there is a crackdown underway, and so it's not out of the realm of possibility that there will be major shutdowns along those lines. Although that's not the only prediction out there. In fact, the chief editor, or maybe he's just an editor, I don't know what his title is, but Peter Berger at Sloan.ru, which is – Sloan has actually become one of the kind of premier – oppositionist, or at least sort of independent.
It's one of the most quality of the.
Yeah,
quality,
and I think they actually absorbed a lot of the staff from Lyanta when there were all the mass resignations there. There's now this thing called Bystry Slon, which is it's this funny fast elephant thing, and numerous people have told me they now think that that's the sort of best kind of internet news source, mm-hmm. Whereas the sort of best traditional newspaper remains Vedomosti. Right. So you have like that again. That's just a sort of perception common, I think, among Russian oppositionists. But at any rate, Sloan is the sort of center you'd expect to get kind of a more critical take on anything that comes out of the Russian government. But so this Peter Berger guy, he put out this article, I guess it was yesterday, and he gave five reasons why he thinks that Facebook, Twitter, Google, etc., will not be blocked. And that this new law that you mentioned in the introduction is in fact, it's not an attempt to shut down these institutions. And
it's an attempt to do what? To keep them under tabs or?
Well, I mean, the article itself is not so much about what it is for. It's more to sort of beat back against the worry that they're trying to shut them down. I mean, my own interpretation is it's sort of a halfway initiative in the sort of digital sovereignty realm, mm-hmm. not so much to keep foreign companies out, but to grant the Russian government more access to that data, I think. So even in the law, you know, companies like Facebook, Twitter, Google, et cetera, they have to store, you know, certain kinds of data in Russian territory. The idea, and then that the reason for that is so that Russian police have access mm-hmm. to the data. Now, it's kind of funny, I think, because I mean the reason for this is supposedly, or at least it's sort of the tone is that we have to keep it out of the hands of the NSA. But there's nothing in the law that stops the NSA from. I mean, the data can still be sent to the United States and be stored there as well. According to my reading, and in fact, by storing the data outside of the United States, it actually grants the NSA far wider powers to
investigate
that. So it really, it's in terms of digital sovereignty, it has. The law effectively does nothing to limit American spying power. It really just boosts Russian spying power. Right. But that's not really the way it's sold, obviously. Certainly not in Putin's public statements yesterday, where he made this the internet is a CIA project. Right. It was in response to a question by a pro-Kremlin blogger named Viktor Livanov, mm-hmm. And so it's pitched this way, or it's justified in this the CIA is spying on all of us, so we need to sort of get a handle on this and be sovereign. But the actual law that was passed this week, it doesn't do that at all. It just expands Russian policing powers.
Right. No, they're getting a lot of mileage out of this NSA scandal, I'll tell you that. You had some interesting posts up recently about some of the stuff. Like I hit all like the things that made the headlines in these laws, but you drilled a little deeper and found some clauses that were equally disturbing in a recent post. Can you elaborate on that a little bit for
us? Well, so the two kind of things that I pointed out that, I mean, just when I read through the law that struck me as sort of either kind of – it's just odd, I suppose, is that it, at one point in the law, it says that bloggers that fall under this, 3,000 audience.
Right.
Because this law doesn't apply to all bloggers everywhere. It applies to bloggers that land on a registry as identified by Roskomnadzor or whatever agency is tasked with this. Once you get above 3,000 or they determine that you are above 3,000, then all these regulations come into effect. One of them says that you can continue to publish under a pseudonym. But then there's another part in that law that says you also have to publish somewhere on your website your name, your real name.
So what's the point of the pseudonym, right?
Yeah. So, depending on how they enforce it, I suppose, it seems to me like they also just banned anonymity among these new popular bloggers. And then the other curious thing is that once you land on the registry for three consecutive months, if your traffic is below 3,000 subscribers, and again, I'm not sure how individual sites or individual bloggers are supposed to know this or prove it. Again,
is that
the law
unique visitors, or how does that work?
Well, so it's not written into the law, right. And all I've seen is commentary from various government officials saying that they will be sure to not be counting bots.
Uh-huh.
That's all I've said. So I would assume it's unique visitors, but again, this is not specified in the law. This is one of the points in that Sloan editorial that I mentioned, is that there's so little specified in the law that one of the reasons to think that it's not a death, this isn't like a death blow to Facebook and all that, is that there's so much wiggle room available that the Russian government will probably just use it like they do all the rest of their laws, which is to just pressure when they feel like it.
Right, to selectively apply, yeah.
Right, but the thing is that so the bloggers, after three consecutive months of lower than 3,000 subscriber traffic, whatever, they can then appeal to be taken off the registry. Now, if they don't appeal, the government can take them off itself after 6 months of consecutive uh-huh. traffic below 3,000. But the law just says that they are allowed to do that. It doesn't say they have to.
They have to,
so
right.
bloggers that either are unable to confirm this sort of data, or just don't even try. Maybe they're out of protest, for instance, they don't want to even interact with the government. I have no idea. But if they were to not do that, let's say, or if maybe they formatted their appeal to the government in an incorrect way, as is a popular way of dismissing, you know, that sort of thing. The state is under no obligation to remove them from the registry, even if they delete their website, I suppose. Even if they have zero audience. So the law, it's either a contradiction or it's just kind of an Orwellian wording. It's a very strange document, and it's no surprise that people hate it so much.
Right. Sean, we discussed last week the degree to which Putin's changed the conversation in Russia rather successfully when we talked about his annual call-in program. He also seems to be changing what I'm calling the architecture, that is the architecture and the infrastructure of communications, or at least he's attempting to do so. Do you see the Netroots on the ropes, or do you think Russia's online activists can find a workaround? I mean, this is the eternal debate on this. Can kind of the Netroots stay a step ahead of the state? How do you see this playing out?
I think inevitably they'll stay a step ahead, because each time the government tries to restrict them, new avenues will be found, new technology will be implemented, and I think essentially the Russian government is in a constant state of playing catch up with activity on the internet.
Right. Now, Kirill, we've often talked about the contrast between the internet Russians and the TV Russians, so to speak, which kind of was one of the divides in the country. What do you see happening here? Is the internet side in for a serious blow? How do you interpret these events?
First of all, don't forget that so-called TV Russia partly is also online or internet Russia, because they use, you know, online banking, online and everything.
No, but I mean in terms of a source of information.
That's a very important question, because when I think about, you know, especially last remarks by Honorable Vladimir Vladimirovich, the first word which is coming to my mind is ignorance, total ignorance on the various levels of life. Well, first of all, the very mistake that you had mentioned about that internet had been invented by CIA. Yes,
but what I don't get is this: it's no less sinister to say it was invented by the Pentagon.
Yes, it's a very important, you know, psychological thing. First of all, he used to speak lies so often that he cannot divide, even, you know, when it doesn't important who was the inventor of the internet, CIA or Pentagon. He's speaking what he is thinking about just now, not, you know, ever checking the facts and so on. He used to speak lies.
But it's a calibrated message.
But psychologically, it's very important. He's just losing the sense of limitations.
That's, I would point out that in 2010, Putin said that half the internet is
with pornography. I know. So if you put these two things together, the CIA invented pornography.
Right. So
secondly, it's an ignorance on the, you know, technical fields and so on, as Kevin told. So everything is stupid. The legislation is stupid. The rhetoric itself is stupid and so on. And I think in this particular field, this is quite dangerous for the for Putin himself, because trying to limit the influence of online world in Russia, he is at the same time beginning to irritate this part of TV Russia, which is also online Russia. He is undermining a lot of Russian companies who specialized in online services and so on. Don't forget what happened to Yandex for last, you know, 2-3 days. So
you mean with the no longer ranking the blog, the top blogs?
I'm speaking about the financial situation on the Yandex, on the, you know, everyone knows about the losses and so on after these remarks. And at the same time, he's opening doors for foreign companies, undermining Russian internet companies. He's supporting consciously, but anyway, international business and foreign companies who are specialized in this. By the way, just, you know, undermining Yandex, who will use who will, those who will, you know, leave Yandex for
go to Google.
Last, yes, go to Google. Yeah,
but Google will have to have its servers in Russian accessible to the FSB, right? I mean.
But anyway, we are not speaking about those who are very interested in the security of their, you know, personal data and so on. I am speaking about, you know, so-called ordinary people who are just fed up with all this stuff. Mm. And they don't want to bother with, you know, Yandex and so on if they can use much more, you know, predictable things.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's quite dangerous because when Putin is fighting with liberals, opposition, and so on this, you know, virtual fields, he can win, you know, a battle, but not, of course, the company. But now he is trying to reach the territory of those who are even theoretically his supporters, mm-hmm. and that's, you know, not such wise.
Kevin, would you agree with that? You're following this pretty closely, like I pointed out. Would you agree with Kirill's assessment?
Well, I think it is really interesting because on one hand you have Putin, you know, supporting. I mean, it's the Duma that passed this law, but let's just say that, you know, it's Putin's law, just as every law is, I suppose. Right. So he's passing these laws are being passed that will presumably diminish the popularity of services like Facebook, Twitter. You know, you've got Yevgeny Chidikov, who's already with their own gated community, right. Doesn't want to be a part of Twitter anymore because it'll have to cooperate with the Russian government, etc. But then at the same time, you have Durov getting forced out, and you have this pressure on him for the last year. I mean, if the thinking was let's get people to use Russian services because these American services are a danger, then why would you be pressuring Kontaktia to in any public way, certainly.
In any public way, right.
Yeah, they would chase people out of those services. I mean, again, I think that this is all being done and I'm not sure if maybe this does agree with what Kirill was saying, or maybe not, I'm not sure actually. But it's being done really without any thought for they're trying to sort of leave the opposition with nowhere to go, I guess.
Yeah, but they're always going to find some place to go. And this is
mentioned... if they go somewhere like a gated community, good for them. Go have a party. I mean, the point is that if they're not accessible, if they can't grow their audience, if their audience is that sort of inward looking, I guess, and gated off. Then the Kremlin has won, I suppose.
I guess. I mean, you've got a couple of different models here going on. This is this is a nice segue into where I wanted to go because you have Durov's new project, this Telegram.org, which I must admit I don't fully understand. But
it's just a messaging app right now.
It's a messaging app that's highly encrypted. It's like super encrypted, and the messages can self-destruct if they need to be, so the government can't read them. It's got this James Bondy feel to it. I don't know. This is just based on Durov's words, but a lot of people are saying this is the wave of the future. These kinds of like hyper encrypted.
I don't buy that at all.
You know, I wanted to get your take on
that. People don't care about that. I mean, people like Durov care about that because he's the sort of person that watches The Matrix 30 times in a row and believes that. I mean, and that's a rumor that may be true. But it, you know, just look at him. He clearly watches
all three movies or just the original?
I think just the original if he's a purist. But I really don't think that. I mean, just intuitively, you know, anecdotally, I do not know very many people that care how encrypted their stuff is. I mean, I don't. And again, Telegram is just a mobile messaging app. You download it on your smartphone, and you can. It's a replacement for text messages. It's, you know, right. It's cheaper if your telecom charges you for individual text messages. That's what it is. It's his version of WhatsApp, which is the most popular. It's what Facebook just bought.
Right.
And so Durov has said he's you know, he's a rival of Facebook for now, this new reason, right? Because now he has Telegram that's going to compete with WhatsApp, which is now Facebook's property. And so I don't see the encryptedness of it becoming, you know, what'll make it so popular. I mean, if it's just a good app, when it is a very clean.
Is it? You tried it? Because
it's a nice looking app. It's good stuff. And it's free. So what's to complain about?
For a rival of Facebook, he posted his latest message to the public on Facebook yesterday.
In English.
In English, yeah.
But he said he was at some kind of conference, and he doesn't tweet very much, and I think it was a tweet, but he said something like, he was listening to someone, he said, like, I don't know why Facebook keeps trying to pretend as though it'll be around in so many years. So I wouldn't say he doesn't like Facebook, but I believe he considers himself an adversary of Facebook. He would like to be better than Facebook. He would like to be more to have produced something that beats it. And maybe that's just good spirit.
Right.
But I'm not sure if I see Telegram going anywhere other than, you know, just being a kind of another option for people that use these sort of applications. But he's now talked about expanding it into a whole social competitor of Kontakte and Facebook. Again, okay, you know, there's lots of social networks out there. If he wants to make another one, good, great.
Right.
I mean, the success of Kontakte, for the most part, and this may be overly cynical, but I do believe it explains a lot, is that for the longest time, and to a certain degree still today, you can go there, you can watch movies, you can download music, watch pornography illegally. It's all free. It's uploaded illegally. It's just a big illegal media center, and that's how a lot of people use Kontakte, and it's a great service in that respect.
Right. No, I wanted to talk a little bit about Dudov himself, because in a lot of ways, and this guy is 29 years old. He's worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. He's everything Russia once said it wanted. A successful kind of entrepreneur that built his business empire up. But yet we have him fleeing the country now. Kirill, this is a story that happens again and again and again, isn't it?
Yes, and that is another. So I'm not.
I mean, is Russia ready for a Pavel Durov?
I'm not pretending that I'm, you know, a sort of Cassandra and so on. But it's it's a tragedy from contemporary Russia that, you know, young, bright, minds are just leaving the country. And when I began to speak about the total, you know, ignorance of the authorities and so on, that is just one of the parts of this, situation. Because the authorities, they think about the country, about the society, in the terms of, I'm not comparing, of course, Putin to Stalin, but in terms of Stalinist politics. So their very attitude to the society is that the society consists of the working class, the bureaucracy, military, and some, you know, engineers who and scientists who must be under control. And that's all. That was quite effective in a totalitarian country and totalitarian regime, but it doesn't work even in such authoritarian regime, which is now in Russia. Because technologically, Russia is far behind not just West, but just, you know, India and so on. And if Russia or Putin himself wants to compete somehow with West, or, you know, to be a leader, a new leader of, another one leader of the world, he cannot understand that the country is absolutely backward, in various fields, in medicine, in education, in science, in, you know, whatever.
But here you had a guy in a cutting-edge industry, a guy young enough to be my son, who beat the industry leader in that field in Russia. Granted, for a lot of reasons that Kevin humorously pointed out
Initially, the site was a virtual copy of Facebook, too. I mean, it's gone its own direction since then, definitely. But
isn't that what the Japanese did with cars? I mean,
fair enough. They backward engineered it. Yeah.
But still, I mean, this guy built this and he beat the industry leader in his own home market.
But before we turn him into too much of a hero, his farewell post was saying, you know, now Kontakte is in the hands of Usmanov and Sechin. Now, why is it in the hands of Usmanov? It's because Durov sold his 12% stock to an Usmanov ally who promptly turned around and handed it over to Usmanov. So, I mean, and Durov's whole tenure for the last several years has been reliant upon Usmanov's good graces. And Durov was happy to work in that way, and he made hundreds of millions of dollars doing that. So I do think that, you know, Durov's very good at playing the PR game. He's a weirdo, too. I mean, he does it in a strange way. He's always in the headlines. I mean, why? Because he's playing a game.
Because he makes good copy. That's why.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying he's a villain or a hero, but I do think that, you know, you read one of his posts, his farewell post anyway, and it looks like, okay, well, you know, goodbye to a freedom fighter of Russian information, etc. But he's, you know, his hands are dirty, I guess. He's played the game, and now he seems to have lost, although he got a nice parachute.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, too, that there's a lawsuit against them by the 48% ownership of Fekontaktia, United Capital Group, who filed a lawsuit in the British Virgin Islands against Durov because he inflated his salary and over the ownership of Telegram because they claiming that he developed it with his brother under the auspices of Fekontaktia. So he's not – United Capital Group released a press release yesterday saying that Durov is trying to cast himself as a political dissident, but in fact, you know, he's running because of this lawsuit.
Well, Pavel, if you're listening, I'd love to have you on the podcast out there. I don't know if you are, but I know you're in Europe somewhere.
May I comment on something else? I think considering this law and considering Putin's comments about the internet being invented by the CIA and basically Yandex somehow being connected to foreign powers, within the larger context of what's going on in Russia with a variety of laws that are basically separating those who are patriotic and those who aren't patriotic. So in the sense of them thinking like running out another model entrepreneur, the idea might be, well, the only good entrepreneurs are the ones that want to stay in Russia, that want to work in Russia's interest, and those who don't want to can leave. So I really think this wider kind of general sense, it's almost like an anti-cosmopolitan campaign.
Yes, it is. Yes, I'm glad you said that. Yeah, it is. It is very much like that.
Because it's really separating out what is Russian and what is, you know, some.
Well, this is, you know, for the last year or so, we've been seeing these series of steps that each looked in and of themselves, going back to the anti-LGBT campaign, just irrational and a bit weird and crazy. But now everything seems to be coalescing along the lines of what you just pointed out, Sean, that we're dividing this, you know, who are the real Russians and who are the traitors. And we only want the former. Is this sustainable, though? Can they do this? Or are they going to, I mean, everybody's not going to leave.
No, but I think as long as the crisis in Ukraine fuels this, I think they can sustain it. But over the long term, I don't know. In many ways, this is all began with Putin's return to the presidency.
Exactly.
So it's kind of been sustained for 2 years now, almost 2 years. But whether they can bring it into the future, who knows? But this seems to be the market point of Putin's third term.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. And it's one of the things that he's done here. I mean, we're not there yet, but he's making it more dangerous to speak out online. Of course, we're going to talk in the second half a bit about Navalny. But the internet was always this little safety valve for the Putin regime. And I mean, I always thought that the free internet, especially during Putin's first term, and certainly during the Medvedev, period, was this essential safety valve. It was safe. People could vent there, and it didn't threaten the regime at all. Why have they decided to get rid of that? I mean, was it getting too big? Was it getting too much of a threat? I think maybe that's the case. But taking away that safety valve is potentially dangerous, no?
It is, but I think they basically want control. They want to be able to regulate. They want to be able to go, as Kevin pointed out, they want to be able to use these laws selectively when they need to use them. I think the chaos of the internet is probably more scary than the actual what's going on it.
Right. Now, you mentioned Ukraine, Sean, and this is in a lot of ways, it's a perfect storm for Putin to do all of this.
Because, very much so.
Not a lot of people are paying attention. I mean, we did a story on this week, but it's not exactly making, you know, international headlines. Whereas in the absence of the Ukraine crisis, this would have really been front page news, even in the U.S., I would think, with like Google and Facebook, you know, potentially facing these kinds of threats. So it's kind of a perfect storm. Domestically, it makes it a lot easier for him to do this amid all this nationalistic and patriotic fervor that we see with his high popularity ratings. And what I have to wonder is, inside this perfect storm, will most Russians even care? Kirill, you suggested no. Kevin, what do you think?
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily that they're using Ukraine as a distraction because, for instance, in Putin's public statements yesterday when he made these comments about the internet being a CIA project and you know, reiterating the need for American companies to store their data in Russia. So that, I mean, he justifying that in terms of keeping it out of the hands of the CIA, even though it doesn't actually do that. But at any rate, that was all done because he had just responded to a question about the U.S. sanctions against Russia, and he made a parallel between, well, you've got MasterCard and Visa And they're responding to U.S. sanctions, and, oh, we thought that these credit card companies were neutral. We didn't think they would succumb to pressure of foreign states, but now it turns out they do. And and the same thing has turned out to be the case with the internet. So he's not shying from tying the two together. You'd think if it's a distraction, then he wouldn't.
No, I don't think it's a
distraction.
I think they're part and parcel of the same mosaic.
Yeah.
Along with the whole the Vladimir Putin conservative icon meme, along with the anti-LGBT campaign. And
so I don't think it's that he doesn't want Russians to notice. I think he does want them to notice. He wants to put it out there and say, you know, we are doing this with the internet, and it's because of it's related to everything that's going on in Ukraine, Visa, MasterCard, the West. You know, is it isolation or is it our own, you know, is it our destiny to develop this way? And maybe this is the best way after all. Haven't I been trying to get all of our end our capital flight anyway? And you know, he's really kind of folded it into the narrative beautifully, I guess. And so, I don't think Russians are meant not to notice. I think they are noticing, but in the kind of fervor of the moment right now, they're saying, you know, you're right. Good.
Or those who disagree don't dare speak up. And this leads me, this is the last thing I wanted to touch on before we move on to the second half. And it just came into my head because I was talking to our Moscow correspondent about this story. Is Russia moving toward autarky or trying to move toward autarky? Is that even possible in today's world? I mean, it's if you think of what this generation of Russians have become accustomed to over the last 20 years or so, they've gotten accustomed to a lot of stuff, not just the internet, but a lot of stuff. And that's
they just had the Shell CEO meeting with Putin, and you know, he's bowing to Putin when shaking his hand, and Putin is, you know, giving him Sakhalin 1 rights,
right?
And siding with Gazprom over Rosneft. So I don't think everything has changed. I think that there's and in that respect, he's sort of leveraging, you know, Western oil companies against sanctions against their home state governments and so on. So I don't think it's autarky necessarily, but I do think that when it comes to sort of the information sphere, politics, war, etc., there is this sort of push for more Russian sovereignty,
right,
more Russian power. They feel like they're at a, there's a, you know, there's not a missile gap, there's a Facebook gap.
Right. I mean, maybe not full autarky, of course, is impossible in today's world, but more autarkic than your average Russian has been accustomed to. And once people start to feel the effects of that, Kirill, let's close with you, because you had some things to say about this early on. Go ahead.
You know, you can be policy like, you know, Mussolini did in the 1920s and 1930s. Yes, that was the same. But as far as I know, he was the inventor of very term autarky, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to, you know, follow this sort of or type of policy, you must have something instead of foreign goods and foreign stuff. All the attempts, Russian attempts to produce something instead of, or sort of Russian substitute for something foreign, just failed. You know, just let's remember GLONASS system.
Right.
Where is this famous, you know, GLONASS system? Instead of it, just, you know, which was supposed to be a substitute for GPS.
Right.
Where is it? Nowhere. The only one, as we just discussed, the only one, you know, person who invented really something which is, which we can, you know, name or call a sort of substitute for Facebook, Pavel Durov, he is now abroad.
He's shopping for a new country,
yes,
as he put
it.
Yeah.
What else? What can Russia suggest for all this, you know, foreign stuff? You know, of course, kvass instead of Coca-Cola. Maybe. Just try to mix kvass with rum or vodka, and I'll see the consequences of this.
I would rather not go there.
Yeah. it's a joke, but anyway, you know, Russia is not a place where things had been invented and produced for the last 20 years. So I can say in this
and one
way.
Has to wonder. Yeah. And I'm reminded of a funny tweet I saw, an unintentionally funny tweet I saw this week. Somebody tweeted, a Russian tweeted, "I'm Mao boycotting all American products." And at the bottom of the tweet, it said, "Tweeted from my iPhone."
Yeah. That's absolutely true. But even, you know, and I'm not speaking about, you know, some high-tech level and so on. Just, you know, food.
No, I'm talking basic, banal things.
Yes, you know, whatever. Everything is imported. And Russia and Russian authority must understand that that is true. And that I was, you know, having in mind when I spoke that now Putin is crossing the line.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to reach territory of his, you know, potential supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And that is dangerous.
And that's as dangerous for him. Sean, I lied. I said that was the last word. Sean gets the last word before the second section.
In terms of trying to establish some sort of actual economic autarky, I think certainly he wants to stop he wants to do de-offshoreization. That's definitely the case. Mm-hmm. But I think that for the most part, Putin's third term has been based on kind of the affective aspects of politics. And what I mean by this is trying to tap into people's emotions, their sense of traditional values, their sense of kind of patriotism. And the actual economic stuff I don't see happening, but try to get people mobilized in how they feel about Russia more than anything.
Okay, well, we'll continue. We'll definitely be continuing this theme going forward. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the plight of Russia's most famous blogger. Has Alexei Navalny been effectively silenced? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine, NZ. And joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And joining us via Skype from Middletown, Connecticut, is Kevin Rothrock, editor of Runet Echoic Global Voices, author of the blog A Good Treaty, and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
It is absolutely clear to me that it is just one more attempt to drive me into a corner. You can't do this, you can't do that. We put him under house arrest, but he still continues to post on the internet. So let's fine him for those posts.
Well, with all due respect to Alexei Anatolievich, it seems they have pushed him into a corner. I mean, a year ago, hell, 6 months ago, Navalny was omnipresent. He was everywhere. Now he's practically invisible. His blog's still active. I just read a clever post last week slamming the end of mayoral elections as, quote, violating the rights of ethnic Russians. It was vintage Navalny. It was funny, clever, and spot on, but nobody noticed. I mean, I noticed, and I didn't even blog about it. Sean, is this the end of the Navalny phenomenon? What do you think?
It's hard to say if it's an end, but it points to one of the things that we've said consistently on this podcast, the inability of Navalny kind of to define the agenda. He's more of a reaction to the agenda, and right now there's not much to react to.
Well, he's reacting, but nobody seems to be listening, though.
Well, it's hard to get a lot of attention when everybody's attention is kind of tuned into Ukraine and tuned into kind of patriotism. So he can't really fit into this narrative very well. At least it seems to me that he can't make an impact to become noticed. Mm. And I think the house arrest is quite key here. I mean, without him being in the streets, without him having a physical presence, it seems to be hard for him to kind of maneuver and kind of fit himself in the narrative.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Kevin, does this show that the virtual Navalny is kind of hollow without the Navalny of the streets?
Yeah, I suppose I agree with mostly with what Sean is saying. But the other thing I'd ask is, you know, are there any other oppositionists right now that are in the headlines so much? And the answer, I think, is no.
No, absolutely not.
There have been times when, you know, it's like, well, what happened with Nemtsov this week? Well, what happened with, you know, with Chirikov or with Sobchak or with, you know, what's like Zhedko saying on Dorst right now? And, you know, you still have a bit of that going on, but it's usually what are they doing in relation to Ukraine? You know, Navalny had this op-ed in the New York Times about the sanctions, and then the sanctions came out and had a lot of the same names. So that was news. You know, I don't know if it was necessarily the kind of news that Navalny was hoping for, some of it was certainly. I do think that right now the whole opposition, not just Navalny, is kind of tied to what's going on in Ukraine. And so, maybe the
the more interesting question is what happens with when Ukraine settles down.
I think that will be the true test.
Yeah, because I mean, the fact that Navalny can't set the news agenda while there's like war happening is, I don't know. I mean, did anybody expect that he eclipsed war?
No, he didn't. But you have to wonder. I mean, and yeah, you're right to say, yeah, we're not asking every day what's Nemtsov or Kasparov or whoever in the opposition doing. But we've always said in this podcast, and I think this is true, Navalny was something different. I mean, there was the opposition and there was Navalny. Maybe.
So I agree he was different. But is he, I mean, like, even if he's like the star far and away, you know, the entire rest of the opposition has got to be at least equal to him. If the opposition sans Navalny and the opposition as Navalny, that's got to be roughly equal, right? I would think. And right now, the opposition just isn't in the news so much. Right. They have these rallies, these peace rallies, or these, you know, quasi peace rallies, and yeah, they kind of make.
They
news,
got a pretty decent turnout.
The thing though is that they have, you know, pretty decent turnout. But it's not in any way creating the atmosphere of, you know, Bolotnaya and the winter of discontent and all that. I mean, I just think that right now it's just not the news season for that. And it'll be curious if Navalny can't stay in the headlines or be in the headlines when the news cycle shifts back to Russia. Because right now anything happening in Russia is kind of not – I mean, you know, you've said before that maybe this internet crackdown is somewhat under the radar. And I'm not sure that the government is presenting that way, but effectively
not just it is.
The internet, everything is kind of under the radar. I mean, and this happens, I think, in any circumstance. You know, when the Iraq War was big news in the United States, I can only imagine, you know, how many schools, you know, burned down or something in the homeland, and it just wasn't covered because people are busy looking at bullets flying.
No, I can tell you as somebody that's in editorial meetings in a newsroom every day, and you feel it because it's, you know, what are we going to do about Ukraine today is the top question every day. It's not what's going on in Azerbaijan or Armenia, where things are going on, important things are going on, but we're throwing all our resources at this because this is huge. Kirill, you were shaking your head. What do you think? Is Navalny finished, or is he just biding his time to fight another day?
Definitely not, I think. And
definitely not finished, or definitely not biding his time to fight another day?
No, definitely not finished. Yeah, in some sense, I'm an optimist.
This is great. This is role reversal. Yeah, this is awesome. Kirill the optimist. I never thought I'd live to see that day.
Everyone is changing. Yeah? But speaking seriously, first of all, there are no Russian headlines which could include the name of Navalny out of legal context no more. And that is a part of my answer. Of course, when there was, you know, old Lenteru, when there was old Gazetaru and so on, that was a sort of media platform for such activity and so on.
Dosh TV.
Yes, Dosh TV in some sense. But so I'm speaking about really important and really popular media. And Lenteru was definitely such thing. Gazeta.ru still is, but the editorial policy changed, of course, and the very content of the media is changing now. But at the same time, I can say that, of course, Navalny's agenda is much more sustainable than, you know, all this Ukraine stuff and so on. It's all about corruption. Corruption is a real core of modern Russian life. And that is not the question of how popular could be, you know, anti-corruption struggle in Russia now. The question is, how can Navalny succeed in this? And how he can use some new instruments, some new tools, some new, you know, sub-agendas to go on fighting? And I have even, you know, some technical remark. I am an absolute technical idiot and so on. But anyway, Navalny is using a very archaic things in his, you know, activity online. It's a live journal.
Mm-hmm.
Live journal is a bit backward, yes, and outdated now. Of course, such long texts with, you know, a lot of links, hyperlinks to, you know, some documents and funny pictures and so on. All this was, you know, up to date, you know, 5 years ago, but not now. Not now. I think Navalny, he is very smart. He is very brave. He is a real man. But the most important thing which he needs now is to change his high-tech files.
Maybe he needs to hook up with Dudov to link the two
maybe,
sections.
By the way, I was thinking about this after, you know, this all this happened to Dudov, because it could be a very useful thing. You know, good, you know, great brains in high-tech and, you know, good
brains in political organizing.
Yes, and so it's a very good combination. My third point is, I think that the recent events in Russia and Russia, Ukraine, and so on, sort of, you know, the moment of truth for various parts of Russian society and individuals. The question is, if being put to test Russian business community will, you know, give up everything and not to fight for their rights and so on.
Yeah, this is, one has to wonder about that.
First of all. Secondly, if Russian society itself and even opposition will, you know, go on fighting but using some other things and so on. And the most important thing, if they can set a new really popular agenda, which is, you know, could be popular among so-called TV Russia. Mm-hmm. That is the question. It's not the question of the oppression or some, you know, evil from Putin administration and so on. It's the question of how they can define themselves. I mean opposition leaders and so on, and how they think about the Russian, you know, society and the future of the society.
I think you made a really good point, Kirill, saying that this is not what the Kremlin's doing now is probably not sustainable. And I'll go back to the quote I used on last week's podcast from Walter Russell Mead, saying each of these patriotic victories is like a hit of cocaine for society. But hits of cocaine wear off and you need another hit.
Yeah.
You know, so after the Ukrainian cocaine comes, I don't know, the Moldovan cocaine and the Kazakh cocaine. And if they really want the strong stuff, they can, you know, do something in Estonia and go for the NATO cocaine. But that might be a fatal dose, possibly. But on the other hand, what you say is Navalny is offering something more sustainable. I don't know what the drug metaphor is, maybe caffeine Prozac, I don't know. But he's offering something more sustainable, but is he going to be able to connect with this? You know, I mean, I'm wondering, where are all those people that are all on the streets for Navalny, that were hysterical on the streets for Navalny during the mayoral election? I mean, the night he was initially sentenced to prison. These people were on the streets and they were full of energy and commitment. Where are they? Has he lost his support? Has the Kremlin kind of undercut his support? Sean, what do you think?
I don't think he's lost his support, but his support is based on events. It's a support that it reacts to certain events. And this is one, like I said again, that one of the things about the Russian opposition is they haven't transferred into kind of normal everyday politics and start building movement building. Mm-hmm. They're still very reactive, and Navalny is the kind of head of that.
Right. Now, but one of the things where they may have cut his legs out from under him is as on one of his greatest strengths, which is also one of the things we on this podcast have criticized him the most for, and that's his nationalism. Because they kind of have taken granted, and with a hat tip to Mark, yes, Putin's using state nationalism and not ethnic nationalism here, but they've kind of taken the patriotic wind out of his sails because he's opposed this thing from the start. And to do so right now is not popular in Russia, and it's certainly not seen as patriotic. Whether it is, I mean, I think it actually is very patriotic to oppose this, but it's certainly not perceived that way. Kevin, what do you think? Do you think they've taken the national, taken away his nationalist thunder with this Crimea campaign?
Well, it's interesting because the Russian nationalists have kind of split on this question. So people like Navalny, people like Vladimir Milov have opposed Russia's, mm-hmm. you know, incursions into Ukraine. And then you have people that are very anti-Putin, like Yegor Presvirnin, the guy who runs Sputniki Pogrom. And he's doing backflips.
Right.
And again, I guess I would say that Putin's nationalism isn't entirely state nationalism, mm-hmm. right? He started using Ruski more than Russian, he's starting using the term Ruski in more circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole notion of defending, you know, Russian speaking communities in Eastern Ukraine has a sort of ethnic quality to mm-hmm. it, or at least linguistic, but it's not specifically state, I think. Mm-hmm.
I'm just reminded of a comment you made in an earlier podcast where you correctly pointed out that Putin, despite as much as we criticize him, did a lot to develop kind of civic patriotism.
Right.
As opposed, has this caused you to kind of rethink that? Or because I've been thinking about this myself, actually, because there has been a shift now.
Well, I think, I mean, I don't really know. I don't know what Putin believes in his heart, but certainly the way he's going about, or the way the Kremlin and Russian rhetoric is right now going about defending or proposing to defend Eastern Ukrainians because of their linguistic and also, I suppose, their ethnic qualities. That's not in the spirit of civic patriotism.
Right. No, it's not at all. And this leads me to the last thing I wanted to touch on before we go. I just kind of am doing this on the fly because I want to do a whole podcast on this in the future. And that's that this whole thing, I know it's caused me to have a big rethink about Russia and a big rethink about Putin and a big rethink about a lot of my assumptions about Russian politics. And I was wondering if this was the same case for you all. If it's caused you to really kind of reassess where you are and how you evaluate this. So I'm sorry to throw something unexpected out there, but just I thought it'd be a cool way to close out, and it's something I want to do in the future. I want to do a whole podcast on this.
Well, so what I would say is that we've often assumed that when Putin talks about NATO, he's sort of – it's all for public consumption. What he's really doing is he knows that NATO is not a threat to Russia, and he would never do anything of serious consequence, and that it's entirely to sort of ramp up domestic support. Mm-hmm. I would say that, you know, that's there's still some truth in that, because you could obviously argue that everything they're doing in Ukraine now is just an effort to boost Putin's popularity and silence the opposition, et cetera, et cetera. That's totally legitimate interpretation. But at the same time, I think that apparently, you know, Putin says behind closed doors to American officials, you know, we don't really fear NATO. This is all just because we've been slighted by the end of the Soviet Union and so on. I think that maybe some of that was for foreign consumption, even though it was behind closed doors. And so I think we have to reconsider, you know, is Putin really along the lines of what Mark wrote about earlier in foreign policy. And I've had conversations actually with my wife, who works on Soviet atheism and ideology on this topic. And I think it's time to reconsider, you know, is this is something you've said earlier in this podcast, I think. But, you know, is Putin really the sort of ideological vacuum we thought him to be? Perhaps not.
Yeah, no, I actually would agree with that. You say his rhetoric needs to be taken a little bit more seriously. I mean, his rhetoric is more real. Sean, what about you?
Yeah, my kind of reconsideration of Putin and Russia actually started when he came back to the presidency for the third term, because I thought that they would try to go along a more kind of normal path of succession, and just Putin would fade into the background, though certainly wield a lot of influence, but have kind of somebody up front to kind of let let Russia kind of evolve in a different direction. But since he's coming back, and I do have to kind of concur with the ideological aspect, he's certainly speaking more in ideological terms, and more importantly, he seems to be knitting together an ideological narrative, you know, positioning himself as the kind of defender of conservatism on a global scale, that I do think we need to take him more seriously in what he thinks about the world, how he views the world, and where he sees Russia's place in it.
Yeah. Kirill, what about you?
On the one hand, I'd like to agree with Sean about the particular date of the starting of the process.
I would agree with that too.
Yes, that was, you know, the decision to run for next presidential term. But in other things, nothing new. On the one hand. Nothing new. So everything which I knew and still know about, you know, Russian society, the state of mind of Russian society and Russian bureaucrats and so on, is still here, mm-hmm. still around. Of course, you know, mild xenophobia and so on was a mainstream in Russian society, but not in the public rhetoric of Russian authorities. Now it is there. So I think that in some nearest future it will, you know, just disappear from it if there will be some circumstances, special circumstances for this. But what is important for me as a trained historian and so on, recent events just forced me to think about the failure of the whole project of post-Soviet society, not just in Russia, but in Ukraine and maybe in some other post-Soviet countries also. So I'm speaking about you know, there is 20 years from the, more than 20 years from the, you know, collapse of USSR. All this 20 years was all about that we are living in some, you know, intermediate process between something bad or something good. Or between something, you know, good and something bad. It doesn't matter in this sense.
Depends how you look at it, yeah.
Yes. And that was the very heart of so-called post-Soviet project, that we are living not, you know, in some historical time now. We are just waiting for something. And the event which, you know, everyone was waiting for just happened. And there is no more such thing as post-Soviet societies with all these special features and so on, an agenda and so on. In some sense, Russian post-Soviet society is on the zero level. And everyone can invent, you know, everything as an agenda and put it and suggest it to the society. And that's why I'm speaking about the responsibility of, you know, opposition leaders and so on. Because now, in some sense, the situation is much more interesting and even, you know, adventurous for them.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I previously saw Putin as somebody pragmatic and cautious. I didn't like the direction he was taking Russia in, but I saw him as pragmatic and cautious. Much as Kevin and Sean suggested, what he's turned out to be right now is, or appears to be, is somebody who is ideological and who is a risk taker, at least in this situation. I also assumed Putin was very smart, and I'm beginning to question that assumption now. I'm serious. I mean, I thought, and Sean, you and I, again, we were both blogging about this at the time. Putin, you know, Putin seemed to have, or we thought, or maybe we was wishful thinking, had a master plan. And he was going to, you know, have this smooth transition to Medvedev, manage pluralism with him, keeping an eye on it. And then he was going to be the guy that, you know, finally brought stability, predictability. And I'm not going to use the D word to Russia, but that's where it probably would have headed. And he would have gone down in history as a great leader. He would have had a peaceful retirement and Russia would be in a pretty good place, I think. And he chose not to do that. To stay in power and now to pursue this ideological project. And that's what I mean by he's not as smart as I thought he was. I was really, if you go back to, you know, 2010, I thought this was all worked out and it was actually quite elegant and quite clever. But it turns out to be we're dealing with something very different. Kirill, you wanted to make one last comment. We got to cut it off.
Yeah. Just a quick, you know, cultural remark. Just reread Autumn of Patriarch by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Okay,
and that is the answer to you.
To my. But no, it's caused me to and to for me to now continuously reevaluate my assumptions, which at the end of the day is a healthy thing. That's unfortunately all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And also joining us via Skype from Middletown, Connecticut, my sleepy and charming home state, has been Kevin Rothrock, editor of Runet Echo at Global Voices, author of the blog A Good Treaty, and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and very overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take a breather next week because I need to catch my breath. But we'll be back soon enough. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.